Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Labor Department trampled all over economic optimism this morning. We learned the unemployment rate rose to 9.5% last month. The economy lost 467,000 jobs in June. And the labor market is as bad in other countries as it is here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. And by the First 5 Years Fund, working to expand early learning for the nation's most at-risk children and provide benefits for society, ffyf.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 2nd of July. Great to have you with us. I think what happened with those jobs numbers this morning was mostly disappointment. The May figures that we got a month ago, they weren't great, about 375,000 jobs lost. And everybody was hoping that was a sign the labor market was turning around a little bit. Nobody really expects unemployment numbers to move uniformly one way or another. But today's report, that came in way worse than anybody expected, has definitely taken the wind out of the economy's sails. And meanwhile, the European labor market isn't doing any better. The jobless rate across the 16 countries that use the Eurozone single currency, the euro, is moving right along with ours, 9.5%, and that eventually could make things worse for us. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The figures are bad, but would have been much worse without the emergency measures in force in Germany. Europe's largest labour market has held unemployment down. Rather than lay off large numbers of staff, German companies have kept them on, working a shorter week, often with a government subsidy, in the hope of an early upturn. Analyst Simon Tilford says that can't continue.
The assumption that there will be a relatively robust economic recovery now looks pretty far-fetched. Hence, German companies are going to start laying off workers in large numbers over the next 6 months.
Europe's biggest economy is heavily dependent on exports. Andrew Hilton is head of the CSFI think tank in New York. He says Germany needs, above all, to see recovery in the world's biggest export market.
If the US economy bounces back, the German economy will bounce as a result of it. But if the recession is prolonged in the US, then again, we will see rising unemployment in Germany, particularly focused in the export sector.
Today's worse-than-expected job figures in the US produced more gloom in Europe. Many economists now expect Eurozone unemployment to hit 11%. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Here in California, the government printing presses are set to roll this afternoon, and they are going to be cranking out $53 million worth of IOUs. Since lawmakers here have failed to find a way out of our budget morass, the state doesn't have enough money to pay its bills. So far, Bank of America and Wells Fargo have said they will honor what are being called warrants, as have some smaller financial institutions. Whoever does decide to accept the notes will get a little interest rate bonus when they are eventually redeemed, provided the IOUs they have in hand are the real thing. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
The state of California is set to print more than 28,000 IOUs today. First in line, residents still waiting for refunds on their state income taxes. The IOUs, or registered warrants, look like regular state checks, but with a difference. Beth Mills is with the California Bankers Association.
There will be a slightly different color. They'll say, you know, registered warrants up on the top, and they'll have the, you know, the state treasurer's seal on them.
Mills says bankers are worried about counterfeit IOUs. Bank of America, for example, says it will accept the IOUs only through July 10th for existing customers. B of A will hold them as deposits for 7 days so it has time to verify them. But Jacob Roper at the California Comptroller's Office says the state is confident in its fraud protection efforts.
We've built a number of security features into the note and have provided banks and credit unions and other financial institutions with those security measures that are proprietary, but are ways that they can independently verify.
The last time California issued IOUs in 1992, Bank of America honored them for several weeks and then stopped. Other banks followed, and a budget deal quickly came together. Here's B of A's California president, Janet Lampkin.
So it's our experience, based on our history here in California, that taking them in perpetuity simply facilitates the gridlock.
State officials said today they'll pay a 3.75% interest rate on the IOUs. That's more than a full percent less than in 1992. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Time now for a quick check of General Motors. It's been a while since we peeked into bankruptcy court. The carmaker has until next Friday to form a new cleaned-up company made up of all the best parts of the old business. Bondholders and other creditors are in court today duking it out over what ought to be kept and what ought to be sold off. And GM does have a lot of property it could unload, including some of its old factories, which gives a whole new meaning to the term toxic assets, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
GM is having a garage sale. At least that's what bankruptcy lawyer Peter Gilhooley at Latham & Watkins is calling it.
Because they do need to sell a lot of things relatively quickly because it's costing them money to maintain them, garage sale is a term you could use.
But just like the old CD tower you find at all garage sales, the one with a few missing shelves in it, there's a lot on GM's lawn that even the crazy neighbor doesn't want to buy, stuff it's been holding for decades. Here's auto industry analyst Dave Sedgwick.
You got to keep in mind, General Motors is, or was, the largest company in the world at one point, and they made just about everything. They made cars, they made trucks, they made kitchen appliances. You know, Frigidaire was a GM division.
GM's more than 100 years old, and just like any centenarian, it's got a lot of junk, including a golf course in New Jersey and a bunch of old factories that are now known to be contaminated with dangerous chemicals. Eric Merkel is president of Autoeconomy.com. He says it's no surprise GM's being weighed down by real-life toxic assets.
If you look at any industrial manufacturer that has been with us for 100 years, they all have plants like this.
Merkel says anyone who wants to buy this stuff is going to have quite a cleanup bill on their hands. And with time running out for GM, it's already a buyer's market. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
A funny thing happened on the way to the closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange today. It didn't ring. Some computer glitches interrupted trading early this morning, so the big board extended things 15 minutes past its usual close of 4 o'clock Eastern. Fat lot of good it did anybody, though. The major indices took this morning's unemployment report right between the eyes. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Believe it or not, we have been talking about tax policy in this country since before there even was a country. Anybody remember taxation without representation? 233 years ago, that idea helped lead to the Revolutionary War and eventually the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Commentator and economist Kevin Hassett wonders, though, whether in the long run it was worth it.
The American Revolution has always seemed like such a big deal. But looking at the economic consequences, I'm not so sure. Our founding fathers make even the most radical, tax-hating conservatives of today seem like pikers. Sure, the British imposed taxes, but they were tiny. One historian estimated the combined burden of the infamous Navigation Acts to be 1% of income. With other assorted taxes, the total bite that ignited revolution was a measly 2%. Imagine what would have happened if King George had recognized the small financial stakes and responded to the tax revolt with more conciliatory gestures. How would our economic lives be different if we'd never gained independence? First, let's look at the governments. The government sector in the UK eats up about 44% of their GDP. Our federal, state, and local governments take about a 10% smaller share. But the main difference is health care, which is provided by the government across the pond. If President Obama gets his public plan, we might well end up in about the same place. What about taxes? The top personal tax rate in the UK is 40%, 5 points higher than we have today. President Obama, however, has promised to repeal the Bush tax cuts. If he does, then our top rate will be 39.6%, again, practically identical to our British friends. The Brits have a lower corporate tax than we do, 28% versus 39%, but have higher sales taxes because of their 15% value-added tax. The Bank of England, just like our Federal Reserve, is an independent institution presided over by an academic economist. It's not clear that even their wives would notice if Mervyn King and Ben Bernanke switched places. The biggest remaining difference is per capita income. Americans, on average, earn about $10,000 more each year. Given how small the policy differences are today, that gap will likely shrink significantly in the years to come. If it does, then economic historians will look back at the American Revolution and conclude that it had little impact on the long-run economic well-being of Americans.
Kevin Hassett is the Director of Economic Policy Studies and a Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Write to us through our website. That's marketplace.org. All you have to do is click on that link that says Contact. On the theory that most of you are going to spend the next 3 days paying less attention to the news than you usually do, we thought we'd send you into your long weekend fully informed about the state of business and the economy halfway through 2009. And so we bring you our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Business writer Heidi Moore joins us, as does Felix Salmon from Reuters. Welcome back, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, got to get your take on the jobs numbers, first of all. We touched on it really briefly up at the top of the broadcast. Felix, what do you think?
Really bad. The number of long-term unemployed as a percentage of the unemployed is the highest it's been since 1948.
You know it's bad when people claim as a victory that it was 9.5% instead of 9.6%.
Right. That's right.
So it's bad, and it does indicate that the economy is broken.
All right, well, hold everything for a second, because if you look at the jobs report today, if you look at the fact that foreclosures are still rising, housing industry is still arguably broken, how can it be that banks are feeling what seems to be pretty good about themselves, Heidi?
A high degree of delusion, actually, which has worked very much to their favor. And I think that, you know, their issues right now with toxic assets and so on still are very much at the top of their minds, still will drag down profits eventually. But what is working for them is that some of the capital markets are coming back. They can trade stocks and bonds. They're doing a few deals here and there. But no one should mistake it for a long-term healthy verdict on their future.
All right, Felix, I want to pick up on that thing she said about toxic assets, because 6 months ago it was all toxic assets. And now all of a sudden the banks can raise capital in the markets. They're reporting profits. And yet there are these bad assets still on the books that, correct me if I'm wrong, everybody seems to have forgotten about.
Not completely forgotten, but largely forgotten. There was this bright idea, you might remember it. It was called the PPIP.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was that banks would all start buying each other's assets off each other with lots of government backstops and guarantees and things like that.
Right. This was the Treasury Department's plan. This was Timothy Geithner's plan.
And that would make everything better again. But the point was that the banks are all really happy about the PPIP because everyone got so excited about the PPIP that the stock prices of the banks went up enough that the banks could issue new stock and recapitalize themselves. And now they're all going around saying, hey, guess what? We're recapitalized, and so we don't need the PPIP anymore because we have all of this extra capital. What they're not saying is that the amount of extra capital they raised is 1 day's worth of write-downs if they actually bothered to mark their assets to what they're actually worth.
Mm-hmm. All right, well then, Heidi, do me a favor and bring the consumer into this, because consumers 6, 8, 9 months ago were terrified, right? We were being told the whole economy was going to go under because of these bad assets. We have now worked our way through that. We've come up with some solutions. There's been a stimulus plan. There's been the bailout. And yet the toxic assets, the thing at the root of this entire mess, are still out there. What is a consumer to think?
Well, the important thing is that we have learned nothing. And
you guys are killing me today, man.
And that will continue to be the lesson for as long as humanity roams the earth. It is true. We haven't learned very much because, you know, consumers need to believe in banks. Banks need to believe in consumers. This is sort of a recovery that will not happen from one side or another, right? So consumers need to act more responsibly and save more money, which it seems like they are doing.
Right.
The savings rate is high. But banks also need to act more responsibly. And in one particular case, you're not seeing that necessarily, which is that in June, banks actually started buying and holding more mortgage-backed securities.
So we talked about this on the broadcast yesterday. Amy Scott had a piece on it on the show. But make us understand why this matters.
Well, it matters because that banker in a suit that you thought had gone back to his normal self and is boring is pretty much in his mind still on spring break in Cancun. And he's acting a little bit recklessly. He's not making a big deal about it. But those subprime mortgages are risky, and the risk is by no means gone from them.
So, Felix, we really have learned nothing.
It certainly looks that way. The banks are using absolutely any means at their disposal to try and get themselves out from under the yoke of government regulation, when what we really need is lots of government regulation. But the banks are going to be the last people to admit that, and it's going to happen over their screaming objections.
Felix Salmon blogs for Reuters. Heidi Moore writes on business and a whole bunch of other stuff. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Cheers, Kai.
Coming up, the perks and the pains and the economics of air travel.
A designer would dream of a larger washroom, a larger seat. But is that a benefit that an end user would pay more for?
But first, let's do the numbers. Plenty of noise at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today, but it wasn't pre-fourth fireworks, more like markets coming down with a bang. When the dust settled, the Dow Industrials was down about 2.5%, 223 points, 8,280 the number. The Nasdaq dived 2.75%, 49 points, finished at 1796. The S&P 500 flopped 2.8%, 26 points, landed at 897. News of more job losses stung the retail sector hard. Macy's lost 6.3%. Best Buy fell 5.25%. Dillard's dropped nearly 5%. Banks took another beating today. Goldman Sachs fell more than 2.5%. Wells Fargo spilled more than 4% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Superbrands, Brandweek's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brandweek Superbrands for more information. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday, July 3rd. The U.S. markets have a three-day weekend, no trading in observance of Independence Day. President Obama will be at Camp David, where he'll spend the holiday. And welcome to the dog days of summer, typically the hottest days of the year. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Later this month, Iraq's northern region of Kurdistan is going to hold parliamentary and presidential elections. The Kurds have been largely independent since the Iraqi army was basically forced to withdraw after the 1991 Gulf War. The region sits on billions of dollars worth of oil and natural gas, so there is keen interest in who wins those elections. But Risa Ehrlich reports from the city of Sulaymaniyah in Kurdistan that not everything seems to be on the up and up.
Critics of the autonomous regional government say corruption is rife. The ruling parties are ripping off hundreds of millions of dollars from a system intended to provide legitimate political funding. I asked Kurdistan Democratic Party leader Mohammed Kader how much his party gets from the government.
I don't know. I'm not in charge of financial matters in the KDP.
So I asked Fuad Hussein, chief of staff to Kurdistan's president, Masoud Barzani.
I don't know. Ask the parliament.
But the information isn't exactly secret. Opposition leader Mohammed Tawfiq read it in an investigative newspaper a few weeks ago.
The speaker of the parliament confirmed that it's true. KDP and PUK each receives $35 million.
That's $35 million a month. The Kurdish government gives the parties $840 million in subsidies every year. Tawfiq says the money is used to build fancy homes for party bigwigs. It also pays for the party's employees, TV stations, newspapers, private militias, and even their own security services.
To maintain control, they interfere in the market, they interfere in the companies, they interfere in contracts.
Assos Hardy, who heads an independent newspaper company, says party officials also make big profits from government contracting. He says they frequently insist private companies take on a sham partner who puts up no money but receives half the profits from government contracts.
If you are not ready to do that, you will not get that project, or you will get it, but they will make problems for you and you cannot finish it and you will lose money. Maybe you will be bankrupt.
The president's chief of staff, Fuad Hussein, admits corruption is a problem in Kurdistan, where the vast majority of the population is Kurdish and where bonds of friendship and clan have always meant a lot. He says change won't come quickly here or in any other part of Iraq.
Corruption in Iraq was part of the culture. And when there is wars, of course, you try to survive. Any ethics will disappear. And to fight the corruption is not so easy.
The Kurdish government has asked the International Monetary Fund and an American accounting firm to help curb corruption by implementing stricter controls and electronic record keeping. The opposition Change List hopes to win parliamentary seats based on its anti-corruption platform. But analysts here say the two major parties seem likely to maintain control. In Sulaymaniyah, Kurdistan, Iraq, I'm Reese Ehrlich for Marketplace.
I can report back from the front lines of the aviation industry today that as many people as ever seem to be traveling this holiday weekend. Three lovely hours in the Denver airport last night gave evidence of that. Airlines, though, are still looking for ways to save or to make a buck. They're charging for checked bags. They're cutting out food, even the peanuts on some airlines. And they're cramming as many people as they can into their planes. Finding new and creative ways to get more seats on a plane that's not going to get any bigger involves some sleight of hand, for instance, making flyers think we have more legroom than we really do. Paul Wild designs airplane interiors for a living.
One can argue that design is always a compromise. I mean, a good designer is juggling the needs of the end user, understanding the manufacturing processes available at the time, the limitations of technology, cost, of course. And also, a designer tries to get their own artistic intent within the project. And of course, you know, designing for aviation is extreme design. You know, you're 7.5 miles in the air and you're traveling at half the speed of sound. And, you know, that brings with it unique opportunities, but then unique limitations as well.
Yeah, it's also compromised by the fact that the economics of the industry dictate one of the key components of that design, which is as many bodies on the plane as possible.
Absolutely. It's always a compromise, and designers always grapple with what is worth paying more for. A designer would dream of a larger washroom, a larger seat, but is that a benefit that an end user would pay more for? We're seeing a polarization of the travel experience, so we're seeing the first-class products becoming even more elaborate, and we're seeing, unfortunately, a lot of the economy cabins suffering through cost-cutting.
So how do you design a new airplane, the interior, to get more space for those seats?
There's lots of ammunition that a designer can potentially use to give the illusion of greater space. We try to keep the plane interior as simple as possible, and we refer to this as the form language. So spaces which have more curves, floating elements, so parts of the aircraft interior that don't actually meet each other, they appear to float in space. And trying to increase the sensation of perspective within the cabin. These are all tricks that designers try to use. And there's clever things we do with lighting. We can illuminate the cabin ceiling in interesting ways. We can play with colour and intensity of lighting. And we can also add some clever tricks such as mirrored surfacing to give the illusion of greater space.
There is, though, a finite limit. No matter how clever a designer you are, you can't get more bodies on a 737 than you can get on, right?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we've really kind of hit on a brick wall now. So it's about trying to create the illusion of space, and it's about trying to provide more comfort on a micro scale. But ultimately, we've got a restricted space, and it's up to us now to try and reclaim space in an interesting and engaging way.
Would you be disappointed if I told you, and I'm going to just guess that I'm speaking for the flying public here, that when we got on an airplane, we're not looking at those floating design elements and lighting stuff. We're keeping our heads down, cramming our bags in the overhead bin, and hoping we we don't get a middle seat?
Well, I've debated this for years. You know, I don't think people do identify all of the hard work that's gone into creating an aircraft interior, but a passenger will reflect upon a good experience or a bad experience. So there's no doubt. They won't deconstruct the elements, but they'll appreciate that overall they've had a better experience.
Paul Wild at Teague Aviation Design up in Seattle, Washington. Paul, thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, in which we observe that it is Thursday, not Friday. Still, though, we're going to take a break from the big economic news of the week and let Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan loose to do what they do. Namely, ask some of the Marketplace staff what they'd really like to talk about. News that might have escaped your notice. Something you might like to talk about at a 4th of July party this weekend.
Managing Editor of Marketplace, George Judson, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to ask people what their dream theme restaurant is.
And what prompted that question?
The Clinic, which is a new restaurant in Singapore. It's done up in medical equipment.
Rehab while you eat?
Well, you can get your drink by a drip.
I used to joke about wanting a martini IV, but now that it's a reality.
The question is, do you really want it?
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, you know, you may have heard that China was going to require that any computer sold in the country had to have this porn-blocking software on it.
And it is not anymore?
No, they just changed their mind. It turns out this software they used also blocked things like Johnny Depp's face and the lovable cat Garfield.
Oh, my. But here's the thing. This is the internet. There could be a porn Garfield.
Exactly. It's like Ron Jeremy with whiskers. It's not cute at all.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, the City College of San Francisco is considering selling naming rights for its classes.
Oh my goodness.
So companies would pay like $6,000 and they would buy the name of a class.
The possibilities are endless here.
I know. Like theoretical math brought to you by Lehman Brothers.
Existentialism brought to you by Prozac.
Oceanography from Exxon.
The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire brought to you by Bank of America.
That is just the briefest taste of Rico and Brendan's podcast. It is called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link to it on our website. It is marketplace.org. And that on this Thursday afternoon is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today the Dow dropped 212 points. It's 2.5%. The NASDAQ lost 49 points, 2.75%. The S&P 500, you ask? Why it fell 24 points, 2.6%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, is fixing it yourself more trouble than it's worth?
I wish people would just stop and think ahead and ask themselves how much it's really going to cost when they try to save a penny.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.